The Splendid Table is listener-supported. If this podcast made your table splendid in 2013, support it as part of your year-end giving. Get a tax deduction and receive a special gift from The Splendid Table. Give at splendidtable.org. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, with the craziness of this time of year, especially this year, the lights are what get to me. The Christmas lights, the candles. You want instant intimacy with people? Just light a candle. Now, those lights come from the old idea that fire protects us from dark threats. You defy this fear of an endless winter by lighting candles, feasting, and for good karma, you fed the needy. It was like stamping your foot and saying, I believe the warmth and the light will come back. So, you know, it couldn't hurt to put a candle in the window tonight and to stick around for this hour of The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. The show for people who love to eat. Writer Juno Diaz has moved into literary rock star status with his latest book, This Is How You Lose Her. Born in the Dominican Republic, raised poor in New Jersey, now Juno is a professor of creative writing at MIT. He holds a Pulitzer, a MacArthur Genius Grant, and an armload of other awards. He writes about Dominican immigrants, people figuring out their lives while they're halfway between memories of their homeland and the realities of a supposed promised land. Juno's still part of the Dominican community in northern Manhattan. It's where he loves to eat and be. Juno Diaz, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you talk a lot about El Alto. You've written about it, and you've talked about the food there. Tell me what the food is like.
Well, I mean, we're talking about a really big neck of the Manhattan woods. And, you know, we have a very large, very dynamic, very diverse community. There's a ton of Caribbean restaurants. So it's kind of a great place to eat if you're a Caribbean food type person.
And I gather you are definitely a Caribbean food type person.
Yeah, I mean, I probably would be even if I wasn't from the Caribbean, given the way my palate runs. But, you know, this is what ends up happening when both your parents were really good cooks. And myself, if I'm looking for Caribbean food, I think a great test is, Can the restaurant cook or even have on the menu goat? Goat is a tough dish, man. Prepare goat well, very, very tough. You know, and some of the old standards in Caribbean food, I'm kind of a pollo guisao man, so the brown stewed chicken, which is common throughout the Caribbean. There's chillo con coco, which is a snapper with a kind of a coconut sauce, which more borderlines on a soft curry. This is a dish that was brought to the Dominican Republic from the Anglophone Caribbean. A lot of folks from Barbados, a lot of folks from St. Thomas, were brought to the Dominican Republic to work in the cane field. So, you know, they brought their cuisine as well.
So, talking about this time of year, what food for you right now means the holidays, means Christmas?
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful question. When my mom and her sisters, when they cook their large holiday meal, it's something to behold because they cook such a wide spread of dishes. It's almost as if they're afraid to miss a food group or miss, you know, someone might miss something. I mean, I think of my mom's pernil, what we would call the pork shoulder, something that she takes days in preparing. This is an essential product. When I think of the way that my mom will roast three or four chickens on top of a turkey, and then stuff both with all sorts of things, but including pork. I mean, my mom will take shredded pork and stuff a damn chicken with it, you know. There's got to be at least two or three rice dishes. There has to be at least three forms of plantain. My mom, if she doesn't prepare two kinds of yuca, something is wrong. She prepares pasteles.
Are those the little pies?
Yeah.
It's like an empanada?
Exactly. But these pasteles, they're boiled. These are really a great holiday tradition. So, you know, your mom will prepare like 200 of them. Depending on what the way you're making them, my mom would make them with a kind of a mashed plantain. In the center, there would be meat. They would be wrapped in leaf, and they would be tied and then boiled.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And these things are really, really the basic staple of the holidays. And everyone claims that their recipe for pasteles is the best. But what's awesome is that you will, like, take 10, 15, 20, pass them on to your neighbors. Your neighbors will pass on 10. It is really the most extraordinary culinary currency in the Caribbean and something you just look forward to. And every family has their trademark. You know, I can detect my mom's pasteles at, you know, you can put one of her pasteles in the middle of 5,000, have me sample all of them, and I could pick out my mom's, my aunt, my neighbors, my ex-girlfriends, you know, because they're really, really individual. And then there's a kind of a grain product called chen chen. People from my part of the country, kind of a, if you would think of a sort of a rural Dominican form of a polenta, is chen chen. And that gets served up with goat. As you can tell, I'm like, me and goat, we have a special relationship.
I gathered that.
And not everyone can eat it. I have to tell you, if you don't grow up with goat, it might be a little rough.
I don't know. It's getting to be pretty popular. And I think, you know, when you think about the holidays, it's always about what you grew up with, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's part of sitting down and sharing a meal with family, with the community, is that food is a remarkable bonding force. When I think of that state that we love to achieve, a state where you're together with people that you love, that you care about, or your relatives, and, you know, for a shining evening or for a shining day, you're able to achieve communion, this kind of peace with each other, this kind of sharing, this kind of communication, this kind of just being in each other's presence. And I think what helps us to achieve that is the dishes that we grew up with, the dishes that are familiar, the dishes that have always meant solidarity and family. And let me tell you, after a tough year, nothing lifts the spirit, nothing lifts the soul like attempting to achieve communion. And what better way than to eat a whole bunch of awesome foods that say family, say community, say home, say love.
Juno, you are so right. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. And, you know, happy holidays.
And to you. Juno Diaz is author of This Is How You Lose Her. His conversation about Christmas in the Dominican communities reminds me of a menu Chef Douglas Rodriguez left with us a few years ago. It's for a Cuban Christmas. There are mojitos, marinated pork, garlic plantain chips, and more. So you can find his Cuban-style Christmas menu on the website splendidtable.org. Steve Jenkins is probably the most highly opinionated cheesemonger in the country. Then again, he's also one of the most respected cheesemongers in the country. Steve's been tracking prime handmade cheeses for decades. He's cheesemonger for the Fairway Markets in New York City and my prime source for ideas. Steve, good to have you back.
Lynn, it's great to be back.
Let's talk cheese for the holidays. What would be your three prime picks?
Well, doggone it, I can't make up my mind. I'm a Libra. It's hard enough anyway. You know, you can do three things. Three things. You can make it Dickensian, like Charles Dickens. It can be that kind of a Christmas where you can't live without an entire round of Stilton that's about 2 inches thick, right cut horizontally off of the 16-pound Stilton, and you can find Stilton every place. and serve with that either the Montgomery's Farmhouse English Somerset Cheddar or the Keene's Farmhouse English Somerset Cheddar, and you've got the two most magnificent Christmas cheeses there are, real cheddar from Cheddar and Great Stilton. And if you haven't tasted Stilton in 20 years, and I'll bet you there's a lot of you that haven't, you don't remember how incredibly satisfying Stilton can be.
All right, you've got me primed. I'm ready to do, you know, the Christmas Carol thing and the whole deal. All right, so if we're not going to do a Dickens Christmas,
yeah,
what would be another choice?
Well, you got to be loyal to your own country and your own local cheesemaker. You've got to go to the best supermarket or best fancy food store in town and say, what do you got from the United States or Canada? And then make them show you what they've got. And then make them go better than that. Ask them what you've got that's from nearby. Who's the best cheesemaker in your particular area? And taste it. I know you're going to love it. And feature it at your gatherings from now until the 15th of January. Because it makes good sense to buy stuff that's made in our own country or Canada, and certainly from someplace nearby. And it's astounding how many fabulous cheeses are being made in America now. Lynn, you and I used to talk about this. Heck, 15 years ago, we would talk about, hey, we're getting pretty good with cheeses in this
yes,
country.
We did.
Well, guess what? You and I are 15 years older, and we've got the most extraordinary artisanal cheese production of any country in the world now. And you and I have watched it happen. I mean, even things that you serve with the cheese. You know me. I think the things you serve with cheese are just as important as the cheeses. Lynn, you guys in Minneapolis have got Sully's Date Jam. And I've got it in all 11 of my Fairway markets. It's this fabulous jam that this guy named Sullivan has been making in your very area for 25 or 30 years, and it should be on every Minnesota table, every Wisconsin table. There are things like that wherever you live. I don't care if you live in Guam. There's somebody there that's making a great cheese or a great accompaniment to a cheese.
So do you usually like to do sweet things like a jam, like a chutney with most cheeses?
I'm fanatical about a sweet component served with whatever cheeses I've selected for my friends. I'm crazy about, like, preserves, a compote, a fruit preserves, a jar of jam to serve with great cheeses is so incredibly satisfying. That sweet component just sets them up. I've got this line of jams from Burgundy, from a little village outside of Dijon called Trinquelin, and they're magnificent. You see them in every Parisian coffee shop with the lid off and a spoon stuck in it. You see my Trinquelinette jams. I'm the only one that imports them. But I'm sure you've got a fabulous fruit preserves that would be wonderful with cheeses. I love apricot rhubarb. I love rhubarb. I love strawberry rhubarb. I've got wild blackberry. I've even got a blood peach. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a blood peach. But
never
there it
heard
is.
Of a blood peach, but who knows?
Oh, my God. Is it gorgeous? And it tastes so good with any cheese you can imagine. But then there's a third option.
And what's that?
Economize. Maybe you live someplace where there isn't a cheesemonger that you can trust, that you can hitch your wagon to. Maybe you're going to have to go to the best supermarket in town and shop in the dairy section. And if that happens, that's okay, because our third option is to go to that supermarket dairy section where you're going to find some actually very good stuff. Bel Gioioso is a big outfit in Wisconsin. They make the best gorgonzola in the world. It's as good or better than anything I've ever had.
Really?
They make domestic Parmigiano. They call it Parmesan or something. But what it is a great, hard, sharp cheese that's enormously satisfying. And they're both very affordable. The Asiago that Kraft makes, that Stella makes. Asiago is a flinty, hard, sharp, marvelous cheese. Cheap as dirt. There's great mozzarella and little balls of mozzarella that you can doctor up. And there's burrata. There's even Cracker Barrel cheddar. And I'm telling you, Cracker Barrel cheddar is delicious.
Cracker Barrel cheddar.
Absolutely delicious. Whoever they've jobbed that out to is doing a heck of a job. It's tremendously delicious cheese. You'll spend a fraction of what you would have spent on those the ones I already recommended, because cheese is getting expensive in this day and age. Maybe you want to economize. You can. Go to your dairy section in your supermarket. There's some really good stuff there.
Steve, you are a genius. As always, thank you, sir, and have a great holiday.
Thank you, Lynn.
Steve Jenkins is cheesemonger for the Fairway stores in New York City. Now, you can find his holiday cheese picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, any of the cheeses that Stephen talked about could be a lunch main dish. And think about adding a homemade component, like a Moroccan cracker that's slightly sweet, slightly salty, and flavored with sesame and anise. It pairs with any of the cheddars that Steve mentioned. The recipe, Anise Biscuits, from food writers Kitty Morse and Danielle Mamane, is on the website, splendidtable.org. Stay with us. Sally Schneider, the cleverest repurposer I know, talks holiday tabletops. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, when it comes to entertaining ideas, especially for the tabletop, I go to Sally Schneider's site, The Improvised Life. Sally is the ultimate improviser as a cook and as a curator of design ideas. Her eye for repurposing is infallible. Well, Sally joins us from New York. Sally, good to have you back with us.
Thanks, Lynn. It's great to be here.
So, you know, this is what I was thinking we should talk about, is tabletop, but also the table itself, because this is the time of year, if you're going to have a gang of people in, this is when you're going to do it, and you need a big table. And, of course, none of us have a big table. So how do you deal with this?
The first thing is to gather up the little tables you have and suss them out, because what you're going to do is make a big table out of small tables. But those small tables are going to be the base for your big table. And my favorite surface for them is plywood. It's inexpensive. It comes in 4x8 sheets. And I even know a designer who made a 16-foot by 4-foot table by putting two sheets of plywood end to end.
Oh my.
Little did anyone know, because the table was so beautifully decorated.
Oh, this sounds like a great idea. And you can, whenever you buy it, they'll cut it for you if you need a cut.
They will.
So now what about seating? That's the other challenge.
Well, one of the things I do is when the not great cook asks, what can I bring? Sometimes I say, bring a chair, if they can get it there easily, or I devise some. I found that stacks of magazines held together with strapping material that you buy at Home Depot that has buckles on it can be great and oddly charming. But my favorite of all is to take, say, three chairs and space them out with a chair or two between them and put a long board across them. That way, you make a long bench, and you can do that on each side of the table at whatever size you want, and you can buy inexpensive poplar boards if you don't have anything in your garage or if you don't have a garage.
That's a great idea.
Now, the person that doesn't have a back to this part of the bench
right.
is going to have to be someone that can sit without a back, so you plan your seating accordingly, but basically, it makes for a festive, close atmosphere at the table that's really wonderful.
And you can squeeze a lot of bottoms on that bench.
As many as you want. You just keep scooting down until you've got all the people you need sat.
Well, let's talk about the tabletop. What about, I mean, nobody has cloths these days. And certainly if they have any cloths, they don't have big ones. So do you do a cloth?
Well, there's several ways to go with this. And luckily, the whole tablecloth thing has loosened up a lot. One way to do that can have great charm is to use small cloths and piece them together, overlap them in a really concertedly mismatched way. Even askew can be lovely. I've been known to make cloths out of ripped linen. But my favorite, my very favorite these days is paper. I'm thinking the wide rolls of paper famously used to cover tables in French bistros. You can buy 48-inch wide rolls, 200 feet long, for $25 easily at an art supply or craft supply store or even on Amazon. It comes in brown craft paper style or white, depending what you like, and you just roll it over the table, let it hang over a bit, and cut it to whatever length you like. And once you have this roll of paper, I mean, 200 feet long is going to cover a lot of tables. So this is something you can be doing. You can also be using it to wrap packages or whatever.
Right.
It's a really great investment. Now, you can leave it as is and then do your table decorations on top of it, or you can decorate the paper itself by stenciling patterns or drawing on it, having your kids draw on it. The best idea I've seen for this was from my friend Pamela Hovland, who drew the place settings right on the paper with the person's name. So she had her seating arrangement.
Right.
And at the end of the meal, she pulled out markers and invited guests to write on each other's place setting the way you used to in yearbooks. And then in the days to follow, she would cut those place settings out, put a mailing label on them, and send them through the mail. So you got this big fat memory of those resonating hours at table.
That's a wonderful idea.
Now, I just would like to talk about the napkins, because this is a part that can provide great luxury very easily. I'm thinking those huge cloth napkins that used to be used in the middle of the 19th century that we'd buy in flea markets that were made of damask that went from 20 to 30 inches.
Oh, yes.
Well, opening one of those is like being tucked into bed. And so how do you give that to your guests? Well, what I do is I buy linen, the ends of bolts or whatever, or muslin if you want to go more cheaply, and just rip it or cut it to size, wash it, dry it, and let it be wrinkled but folded nicely. And your guests will get this wonderful feeling when they're sitting at table.
I'm thinking of that very smooth paper and then the texture of that linen and the crumple.
Yes.
So now let's talk about the center of the table.
This is a blank slate. You can really think about connecting with the season and what you want to visually give your guests. One way I do this is with flowers, but not huge bouquets. I like to have an array of tiny bouquets lined up down the table. I use little apothecary jars, beakers, jelly glasses, whatever. You can also make bouquets out of herbs like sage, rosemary, and thyme, which are very charming. I also go out into the park and see what unexpected beautiful piece of nature is to be found. It could be curls of birch bark, vines, thin, tall grasses, sprigs of a green that has berries or pine. Even dried leaves or a branch can be beautiful. And you can mix these with the little tiny flower, vases, candles, whatever. It's basically your palette that you're dressing here, that you're showing. It's like a painting. And your guests will really feel the season.
I think this is lovely and simple and easy and doesn't cost a lot of money. Sally, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider is the creator of the Improvised Life site. You can check out her ideas on our site, splendidtable.org. You know where you have to eat when you go to New York City? You've got to go across the river to Brooklyn, where the cooks are young and trying all kinds of things. Two of them are the Sussman brothers, Eli and Max. Now, Max is a chef at Roberta's, and Eli is at Mild End Deli. They've done a book on how they like to eat at home, and they call it This is a Cookbook, Recipes for Real Life. Eli Sussman is here. Eli, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you two grew up in Michigan. What was the food like at your house when you were growing up?
Growing up, our mom is an artist, and her studio is connected to our house, so family dinners were required. They were mandatory, and she cooked dinner almost every night from scratch. So they were ethnically diverse, but always using fresh ingredients that she bought either that day or a couple days before. So no microwave in the house, no Chinese food takeout, no pizza dinners.
Sounds like the kind of thing that everybody dreams about having, you know, as their family background.
Yeah, it was great. And, you know, we were always pushed to help out, reluctant at first, but over time started helping out more. And it became kind of a family thing to make dinner and then sit down and eat it together.
Did your dad cook too?
Our dad bakes challah pretty regularly. It's sort of his thing, and he has a couple staples that he does for various holidays like Passover, but our mom does most of the cooking in the house.
Well, you know, the thing I like about this book, though, it's not about professional cooking. It's not a chef's book.
Totally, yeah. It's the opposite end of the spectrum. It's a everyone can get involved type of book.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that I liked is you have a chapter on midnight snacks. Tell us about them.
Yeah, it's fun to come back with a bunch of people after you've been out for the night and just throw a couple things together. And that's why popcorn is something that we highlight in the book. And it's great because it's sort of like a blank slate. You can add anything to it. You can make it sweet. You can make it savory. You can add chocolate. You can add various garlic powders and spices. And that's something that we love to do. You just get a bunch of people. You're standing around in the kitchen and you can just kind of stuff your face with all these delicious flavors of popcorn.
You guys, though, you seem to have a real thing about, you know, an egg. It seems to be a pivotal.
Yeah, the egg is quite possibly the greatest ingredient to have in your house. It's incredibly versatile, and they're really, really cheap too. So you should always have a dozen in your fridge. And we've got a fried egg sandwich, and then, you know, there's fried rice with an egg in it, and you can always make an omelet. You know, we have we call it a frittata, a late night frittata, but really it's just whatever you have in your fridge, you kind of throw it into a pan and mix in some eggs. So yeah, it's an incredible ingredient, and you can do so many things with it.
You know, you reminded me of something when I was looking at the book and looking that you put a fried egg on top of almost anything, you know, a plate of spinach, a salad, a piece of bread. And for some reason, it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's something that we say at the deli all the time. We say throw an egg on it. And it's just one of those things. It greatly improves any type of dish, basically. It's just it's rich, and you can do it sunny side up and just break the yolk, and it's just a really rich addition to anything that you're eating.
What about the thin cut fries for one? Fried potatoes for one person. It seems like a pain in the neck.
No, it's really not. It's super easy. It's something that I do all the time, actually. And I love them because I'm not a huge fried potato fan, honestly. I like the crispiness of a potato chip. So these are kind of in the middle. They're a little bit like a potato chip, a little bit like a French fry. And I'm a big sauce guy. So I get every single type of sauce that I have in the fridge. And then you can just go crazy kind of dipping the fries in all the different types of sauces.
So what do? You just thin slice them and throw them in a pan with some fat?
Yeah, well, you just you use like a baking sheet. And so you put a little bit of oil down, not very much. And then you put them in the oven and you let them kind of dry out a little bit. So certain parts of them stay a little bit moist like a French fry. And then other parts are very brittle like a potato chip.
This sounds like – oh, yeah. Okay, I've got an image now.
It's the perfect it's the perfect drunk snack.
I didn't want to say that.
I didn't know if I was allowed to say it. Sorry.
Well, yeah, but the idea, too, is, you know, you've had a long evening and you've had a good time. And what can you cook that's going to be delicious and everybody will be filled up by it? And a potato or an egg generally is going to do the trick really
exactly.
nicely.
And those are things that you should and can always have around because they're so inexpensive. And that's part of what we try to do is find things that you can afford and that kind of make them a little bit more interesting and fun for the person at home.
What are some one or two basics that you've learned? You and your brother cook. You live together. You've cooked professionally. One or two techniques or things to think about that generally improve almost any dish you're cooking.
Yeah, I think that salt is something that a lot of people are a little bit scared of. And it's sort of an obvious tool, but salt greatly improves anything that you're working with. And you don't have to go crazy with it. You just have to find the level at which you're comfortable that it tastes good. But a lot of people think that salt is sort of the enemy based on, you know, all the health factors.
Right.
But salt is an incredible tool. And we encourage people, we say salt to taste. And all that means is, you know, add a very, very little bit at a time and get it to the point where the dish is incredibly delicious. And then the other thing I would say is that everyone should have a really nice pan, and they should know how to cook something in olive oil to saute something. And that's a skill that is, I think, fairly introductory, but that we really encourage because, you know, if you're making a omelet, for example, or if you're making a pasta dish, it's just a great way to get a lot of flavor out of the vegetables.
And you just – the idea of sautéing them in olive oil.
Yeah,
of
exactly.
Just giving them some cooking in olive oil.
Yeah, just give them a little bit of color and let them break down a little bit so you've got sort of a variety of textures in the dish. And that can elevate something from being incredibly boring and to a dish that you're going to make for the rest of your life.
Okay, so I'm going to stock up on eggs, right? Popcorn.
Yes.
Some bread, and we'll take it from there.
Okay. Yeah, definitely.
Hey, thank you, Eli.
Thank you very much.
Eli Sussman is co-author with his brother Max of This Is a Cookbook, Recipes for Real Life. Now, I like their thin-cut fries for one. Recipes on the website, splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
If it seems we're connecting with you, call us at 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. We've got Callie calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. So, do you have a question?
I do. Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of the show and a longtime listener.
Oh, thank you.
So, my question was, every year for Christmas, I get my mom a cookbook, and she's a really good cook and the best mom, but this year I really want to get her like a super special and super rare cookbook, and lately, she's been making her own cheese, and she's always really into French cooking, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions.
Oh, boy. Let's see now. Well, there's Dory Greenspan's book that came out about 2 years ago called From My French Kitchen. Dory is a genius cook and baker. She writes recipes. If your mother likes the kind of recipes that talk to you, you know, say, and really think out each step. Her recipes are wonderful. Her food, they always work. And,
right.
and she divides her life between the United States and an apartment in Paris. And I think that would be a wonderful book for your mother. Now, as far as making your own cheese, I'm trying to think. You know, if you go on our website, splendidtable.org,
mm-hmm.
And then just do a search for cheese making or cheese maker, because we've talked to several people who have done books on doing homemade cheese, and she might really get a kick out of that.
Okay.
Okay? You have a great holiday, and a great holiday to your mom, too.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Bye.
Bye.
Stay with us. We're going to be back with more of your questions and a check-in with pastry chef David Leibowitz on Christmas in Paris. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Okay, let's get back to your questions. You can call us 800-537-5252. Let's see, we've got David on the line from Fairburn, Georgia. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Fairburn? Is
that
right, David? I got it right. Okay. What's on your mind, sir?
Well, I love to cook for my family, and when the holidays come around, I pull out all the stops. And everything centers around a gorgeous six-rib standing rib roast.
Oh, boy.
And I slather it with horseradish, garlic, fresh rosemary, sea salt, and pepper.
Stop, please. Oh, Lord.
Anyway, so yeah. it's really great. But the problem I have every year is it always gets overcooked. And I'm looking for that perfect, pink center.
Yeah. Now, tell me how you're cooking it.
Well, I have it in a big roasting pan.
Right.
And usually at 325. And I think where I go wrong is I worry it's never going to get done in time, so I kind of creak it up to 350.
And then all of a sudden it's over the top. And
yeah,
I know. I've done that, and it's not a good idea.
Yeah. Well, I thought I had the problem solved last year when my very thoughtful wife gave me a remote thermometer.
Right, that should help.
And I said, okay, this is perfect. So I got it up to a temperature where I thought, well, I'll take it out and it'll go up maybe 10 degrees and it'll be fine.
Right.
So I took it out when I thought it would go up, and it just kept going up and up. And it was like 210 before it stopped.
Oh,
my gosh.
Oh.
So I realized what had happened afterwards is that large a piece of meat just held the heat for so long.
Yeah,
and so that's where my question is with a piece of meat that big, we're talking 15, 20-pound rib roast.
Well, and the thing about this is it's by thickness and not by weight, because it's really like a long, thick tube, if you think about it.
Right.
But I think the key here is, and I have to say I'm a little rusty on my timing for that piece of meat. But generally speaking, I think if you figure somewhere around 15 minutes, 10 minutes to the pound, and I'd check this with a good cookbook. Whenever you have a piece of meat that size and you want to keep it rosy and rare, you want to cook it very slowly, because otherwise the outside gets well done and the inside is rare or close to raw. So what I would do is stick with the 325, and I would pull it out when it's about 10 degrees below, but I would leave the oven on just in case you find yourself running into any kind of problem. But I would pull it out 10 degrees below because it's going to continue to rise.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And really take your time, because my dream of a roast like that is that it's almost evenly covered from the exterior to the interior. Is that what you're going for?
Yeah, it doesn't, because the thing doesn't taper much, it should be pretty much the same.
It's a big block of meat.
It is. It's huge.
Yeah. And those bones carry a bit of, those are a bit of a carrier of heat, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
So I would take it slow and low, take it out 10 degrees below. And the other thing is that rest is important, as you well know. Otherwise, all the juices end up on the platter instead of, where they should be, which is in our mouths.
Definitely.
I hope that helps.
It sure does, Lynn.
Okay. Have a great holiday.
Certainly will. Thank
Take
you.
Care.
And the same to you.
Thank you, sir. Take
Bye-bye.
Care. We have Michelle calling from Salem, Oregon. Michelle, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Well, last year I was inspired by your show to make a selection of seasoned salts for my friends and family for holiday gifts. So this year, I thought I'd try my hand at extracts. So I have the vanilla pretty much down.
Yeah.
But I was trying to think of some other possible suggestions. I was looking for some suggestions on other extracts I might be able to give my friends.
Well, I think one thing that would really be wonderful is to do some citrus ones.
Oh.
With lemon peel and orange peel.
Oh, yum.
They're going to have a bitter edge to them. But it's the same way you do. How are you doing your vanilla at this point?
I'm just sticking the, splitting the bean, sticking it in the vodka, and let it sit for a while.
Okay, so this is what I would do. I would do the peels, do an orange, do a lemon, but I would do the peels and some of the flesh, put it in the vodka with a bit of sugar.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is a case where I think you want a little bit of sugar in there, and let it steep for maybe, a week.
Okay.
Okay, then strain it. And I think you're going to get a nice essence. The other thing you could do, of course, are spice essences.
Ooh.
Cinnamon stick that you crack. So you do a cinnamon extract. You could do an allspice extract. And then the other thing you could do, and this is straight from Holland, believe it or not, chilies in that vodka.
Chilies?
Yeah.
Is there a particular kind of chili?
The hotter the better, depending on who you're. Well, no, really, seriously, though, there is for a medium hot chili that has a real fruity flavor, Aleppo chili.
Oh.
Aleppo chili has a floral quality, a fruity quality, and then a snap to it. You'll need a fair amount of it, and it comes crushed. The best brand I know is Penzies, and you can mail order Penzies.
Okay.
And I'd keep it in the fridge. Get a bag of it, and that way you'll have it for the year. But the idea is put that into the vodka, let it steep for a couple of days, run it through a fine strainer, and you'll have an Aleppo chili essence.
And what would I recommend to my friends to use this? How would
okay.
I use
it? You would sprinkle that over that plate of pasta that mm-hmm. you've just, you know, tossed. Mm-hmm. You would add a few drops to a salad dressing.
I never thought of using it as in salad dressing.
Yeah,
oh.
yeah. In fact, a little vanilla in salad dressing is not a bad idea.
Ooh.
And the other thing is, this is what you can sprinkle over a steak or any piece of meat you're going to marinate where you want a little kick. But alcohol releases more families of flavor than anything else. You know, certain flavors are soluble in water and certain are soluble in oil. And more things are soluble in alcohol.
Oh.
Now, for real heat, you can get some Thai chilies. The smaller the chili, the hotter it's going to be.
Right.
So you can get fresh or dried whole chilies, put that in the vodka, let it steep for several days, then strain it out. And I also love the idea of cinnamon and maybe an allspice. You see what I'm saying? You can,
yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, you mix the cinnamon with the chili.
Mm-hmm.
And you put that, just let a piece of chicken or some duck sit in that for a little while and then slow grill it. So good,
wonderful.
I cannot tell you. So I think that's going to launch you. You're going to have a great gift list.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Have a good one.
Thank you, too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. We've got Sean on the line from Norfolk, Virginia. Sean, what's up?
Hey, Lynn. I was given a gift of bacon-flavored coffee syrup. And
bacon is getting into everything. I love it. I just love
it. No kidding, right? So I tried it in coffee.
Yeah.
Can't say I cared for it that much. And want to know what else I could do with it.
You know what it probably is? It sweet?
It is. It's sweet and salty at the same time. It's kind of weird.
You know what? It's the old reliable, but it always works. Believe it mm-hmm. or not, vanilla ice cream. Drizzle it over vanilla ice cream. I would bet you you're going to love it. And now you've got probably the easiest dessert in the world to serve through the holidays. And people will marvel. You know, they've never tasted it quite before. So I think that would be just dynamite. You know, some scoops of really good vanilla ice cream. The other thing is, do you ever make panna cotta?
I haven't, no.
Okay, panna cotta. We've got a recipe on the site, splendidtable.org. I think it's called Farmhouse panna cotta. All panna cotta is heated cream with sugar and gelatin, okay? And I throw in sour cream, and then you let it chill, and it gels. And it's super lush, super rich. It takes 5 minutes to make. Now, if instead of sugar, or in addition to the sugar, cut back on the sugar, you stir in this syrup, you know, to flavor it, I think it would just be killer. It would be fabulous. And then you could
definitely try and give that a shot.
Yeah, and do some of those crushed chocolate-covered coffee beans on top of the panna cotta. Okay? So it's farmhouse panna cotta. And what you'll do is you'll add it to the cream as you're warming it up and taste, mm-hmm. you know, and see, you know, is this enough? Now I want a little more. And you'll remember you're serving it cool, so you always over-flavor very slightly when you're going to chill something.
Okay?
Sounds
good. Thank you.
You are launched. Goodbye, Sean, and thanks.
Bye.
You know, the other thing Sean could do with that bacon-flavored coffee syrup is flavor whipped cream with it. I mean, it would be fabulous. And, of course, a few drops of that in a martini? I mean, what could be bad? Anyway, send us an email, splendidtable.org. Call us, 800-537-5252. Well, talk about having all the fun. David Leibovitz is a pastry chef living in pastry chef heaven. He's based in Paris. His blog, David Leibovitz, Living the Sweet Life in Paris, can drive you either to the kitchen or to buy a plane ticket. And trust me, the old song may rave about April in Paris, but Christmas there is pretty glorious. Well, David's joining us from his apartment. David, good to talk to you.
Oh, it's wonderful to talk to you as well, Lynn.
So, Paris during the holidays. Am I over the top about this?
No, you're getting me excited.
But, I mean, I remember it being magical. And is it still that way?
It is. I mean, but it's a different kind of magical than I think a lot of people think. Because I live here, I see how Christmas is more of a low-key day. I think people here tend to concentrate more on the food traditions and the sort of slower-paced qualities rather than the commercial qualities. It tends to be a much more deeply felt holiday.
So you're saying it's not necessarily everybody running around with gifts and doing the gift thing and all that?
No, you don't see people hysterical, like in this, you know, shopping and carrying loads of things and, you know, stampeding people in department stores.
But are they stocking up and cooking and that kind of thing?
Yes, big time. You know, the markets are very busy. What's actually wonderful is that right around Christmas, the markets are particularly extraordinary because there's all the game, you know, the game birds. You see things like goose. They call it gibier, which are sort of, which is a word for a game in French. So you'll see things like goose and duck, lots of oysters, foie gras. People really go all out on holiday food, but it's family food. It's not going out and, you know, trying to buy as much stuff as possible.
Right, right. How about the sweets? Do the French bake for the holidays?
Well, people in Paris have little tiny apartments with little tiny countertops, and not everybody has a lot of space or time to cook an elaborate pastry, for example. So most people buy their desserts. Americans, we have a very strong tradition of home baking.
Right.
Whereas French people, they have, you know, there's over 1,000 bakeries in Paris, and most of them are really good. So it's just much easier to go buy something because the bakery does it. They usually do it really well.
So what's in those bakery shops at this time of year? What are the special things for the holidays?
Well, a little before Christmas, you start seeing what's called the Bûche de Noël, which is a Yule log in English. But it's a log-shaped cake, and it's usually some sort of roulade or rolled-up cake. And over the last few years, the Parisian pastry shops, especially the really fancy ones, have sort of tried to outdo each other by creating the most exquisite, the most bizarre, or the most sort of outrageous kind of cake. It's kind of fun to see. I mean, you'll see these ones that have, like, leopard prints all over them. Some that resemble like an Hermes shopping bag or like a designer purse. And it's actually it's quite fun, and they're all in the window and they look magnificent. Another bakery does a snowman cake, which they pipe meringue on, and it looks like a snowman kind of melting into the snow, which I love. I always want to buy one just because I love the way it looks.
I'm picturing all that wonderful buttercream and meringue and how fabulous that's got to be. What about cookies? Are cookies a big thing for the French?
Not really. Cookies are something that you eat with tea or coffee. It's not like there's not the big cookie tradition. Chocolate chip cookies have kind of taken over Paris for a while. And actually, they call them les cookies in English, which is kind of funny.
Interesting.
But that only refers to chocolate chip cookies. But you will see some of the places like Storer Bakery on Rue Montorgueil. They specialize in Alsatian cookies, which are those little Christmas cinnamon stars and things like that that are sort of spicy with that crunchy royal icing that crackles in your teeth. And I love going over there. I go over there and I get a bag of those little cinnamon stars probably two or three times before Christmas and then after Christmas until they stop carrying them.
Do you ever do fruitcake?
I do. There's a lot of derision toward fruitcake. And I actually don't quite understand it because usually they're full of wonderful things, you know, candied fruit, nuts, you can put chocolate in them. But I think people have sort of made, you know, not very good ones. So I came up with one that was mostly dark chocolate, really heavily dark chocolate with candied cherries in it and dried sour cherries.
Mm.
And that's the best. And I put like a Kirsch frosting on it sometimes that everybody loves. And I make that year after year, and it's great.
Sounds fabulous. David, you have a wonderful holiday, and thanks for sharing a bit of Paris with us.
Oh, thanks. It was a pleasure to talk with you, as usual.
Pastry chef David Leibovitz is author of Ready for Dessert, My Favorite Recipes. His recipe for a fruitcake that will not be passed over is chocolate cherry fruitcake, and it's waiting for you at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for tuning in. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Carol Nelson, who said, Holidays, a time when you get homesick, even when you're home. The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. And don't miss our latest edition of Eating In. It's an ebook, and this one is Italian Holidays. Get all the details at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lukey. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM American Public Media.